Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Lunar New Year is on February 1st, and 3 days later, the Winter Olympics kick off in Beijing. And with China maintaining strict COVID protocols, ticket sales have been halted, and the mood in the capital there is tense. Asher Gillespie has lived in Beijing for many years, and he owns a pizzeria there. Its English name is Pi Square.
Fong Pi Pizza. I grew up in Michigan, so it's a Detroit-style pizza place in Beijing.
Are you all going to eat Hawaii, or do you want to do half?
Yeah, we
want to
do half and half.
You order at the counter, and then you go sit down. I've got six taps of different beers there.
In 2000, Gillespie went to China to study as an undergraduate for a year.
And actually, in that time, that's when they announced that Beijing had gotten the rights to the 2008 Olympics, the Summer Olympics. So that was one of the reasons that China seemed so exciting at the time. You could tell a boom was kind of coming, and I just figured there'd be a lot of job opportunities coming. In the era that I was here, so 2000 onwards, there was slowly a growing restaurant community. So you could find barbecue. Eventually some Mexican places came into town. You could find kind of each and every type of food. And actually that kind of went all the way through the 2008 Olympics. And you got it by just kind of having that style of food. And then kind of during and after the Olympics, people came in over the top, and then you had to actually be good at doing that food.
2008 drummers to coincide with the 2008 Olympic year.
The 2008 Games were a huge moment for China, a kind of debut on the modern world stage as not only an economic powerhouse, but a cultural force as well.
And they had that amazing opening ceremony, and we were just all kind of blown away. And then I remember getting phone calls from my parents and some friends just being like, that was incredible. So there was a real excitement for it. You know, it was the summer, it's hot, I think people were working, but it just seemed like 2 weeks of just going around, going to every venue, trying to check out this water polo, volleyball.
Officials are ready. We are ready. Let's get this gold medal match underway.
Beach volleyball, we went to some track and field, we did a baseball game. I don't know, I just felt like there was no shortage of events to go to, and people just kind of handed tickets. Oh, we went to a soccer game. It really, really was a good time.
Argentina!
You know, when it was announced that Beijing got the 2022 Winter Olympics, we were all kind of excited and planning for how to maximize opportunities to do good business and have a good time during those games. You know, this is the one. It's right in Beijing. It'll be live when we're open, right? We have a lot of local Chinese coming into the restaurant, but we also have people from all over the world in our restaurant. And so it would have been fun throwing on the games, having some friendly chit-chat over a couple beers while any event is going on, because everybody's going to root for their country to win, but it doesn't really matter at the end. It's all just a good time, and it's competition. So we would have loved it.
Now, that, of course, was before wave after wave of COVID started hitting the world.
We were all wondering for these last couple months, are tickets going to be on sale? Are we going to be able to go? If we go, are we going to have to be in the bubble? Are we going to have to quarantine before we go in the bubble? Are we going to have to quarantine when we go out of the bubble? So, and these things are kind of changing as, you know, even as we speak. You know, we're going to be watching from TV just like everybody else is.
Asher Gillespie at Pi Squared in Beijing.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The very real complications facing the Winter Olympics in Beijing go well beyond COVID. The Games have put a gigantic spotlight on China's human rights abuses, most critically, the genocide taking place against the Uyghurs. The U.S. government and some other nations are boycotting the Games in a limited way, leaving diplomats and officials at home, though their athletes are competing. I'm joined now by Louisa Thomas, a staff writer who covers sports from football to gymnastics to chess, and Peter Hessler, who's been our China correspondent for many years. Now, Peter, I want to start off with you. Normally, you would be in Beijing for these Olympics, but you're not. How come?
Well, I taught in China for 2 years, 2019 until last July. And then my teaching contract was not renewed. No explanation was ever given. No official explanation was given for that. But it seems obvious that it was for political reasons. And, you know, this has been a period when we've had the expulsion of many American journalists. There's very few foreign reporters living in China right now. I mean, there's very few foreigners in general. There's probably never been a period that has had so few foreign correspondents, foreign observers on the ground in China.
Certainly, it's not the first time that we've seen an authoritarian government in China or many other governments, and foreign correspondents are allowed to stay, and certainly to cover something, a spectacle like an Olympic Games. Why would they clear out Beijing, much less where you were living in Chengdu?
I mean, there's a number of reasons, but I mean, really what kicked it off in a lot of ways was the Trump administration. So the Trump administration expelled Chinese journalists in early 2020. And China immediately countered by expelling most of the American journalists. Part of it was a tit for tat. And then the other element that has really played into this, of course, is the pandemic. They're following a zero tolerance strategy toward COVID, which has been broadly supported by the people and probably, you know, has saved, you know, a couple million lives in China. So that's also part of the dynamic.
Peter, you covered the 2008 Games in Beijing. How do you expect China's self-presentation to differ in 2008 and now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different moment. 2008, they were looking out. I mean, you know, they won that bid in 2001. I was there for that as well. And at that point, I mean, China wanted to prove to the world that it was no longer a poor country, that it had arrived. And so 2008 was this moment where they were telling the world, you know, we are now, you know, a world power, but also a prosperous country with active and engaged citizens. And I think this year is completely different. I mean, in that year, there was a sense that China needed the Olympics. You know, we need this to show the world something. I think that this year, really, the International Olympic Committee needed China, because when the bids for the Olympic Games were made in 2013 and the decision was made in 2015, everybody pulled out. All the European countries pulled out. And you know, Oslo was the favorite. They decided that they didn't have the support to do it. And it ended up just being Kazakhstan, the city of Almaty, and China. And so the IOC decided on China basically because they knew they could pull it off. Focus now is going to be much more domestic. They're going to be playing this to their own citizens, I think, rather than the outside world.
Louisa, over time, Olympic Games leave behind a kind of political historical resonance, whether it was in Berlin in the 30s, Mexico City in the late 60s, certainly the games in Beijing, in Moscow in the 80s. What do you think would be a success for Beijing this time around, and what would be the opposite? What would be a failure in their eyes?
I think, you know, Peter's referred to these games in some ways as a major domestic event. We're used to the Olympics as being as kind of huge international, but, you know, from an American's perspective, largely American event in some ways in which the world comes together. But obviously, Americans are glued to American athletes. And American success, and the NBC broadcast often revolves around that. I think China will be happy to tell the story of how they pulled it off when no one else could, as Peter indicated. And I think that outside of China, it's going to be a smaller games than we're used to in some ways. The Winter Olympics is usually smaller than the Summer Olympics. We're coming right on the heels of the Tokyo Olympics, which were already the least watched games in history. Ratings were down 42% on NBC over Rio 4 years before. So, and there aren't a lot of huge names. You know, 2008 had Michael Phelps, had Usain Bolt. Now we have Mikhaila Shiffrin, but, you know, the major figure skaters are these young Russians that not a lot of Americans have heard of. And there aren't a kind of, there aren't the same kind of, you know, names and bright lights that NBC is promoting in quite the same way. So I think in some ways, this is a games that is perhaps more than any others, like sort of flying under the radar for American audiences. And it will be a success, I think, if people know about it in some ways, because I even have a lot of friends who actually have no idea that there's about to be an Olympics, which is extraordinary.
Peter, what are the COVID restrictions? What are the COVID precautions like in Beijing as you understand them?
If you go to China now, which is hard to do, you have a long quarantine, usually 3 weeks or more. So they're not doing that for the commentators, for the athletes, but as part of that, they will have no contact with Beijing citizens. So, you know, everybody going to the Olympics, all the people covering and the athletes are in a bubble. I mean, 2008, I mean, my favorite moment of those games was when I was at a wrestling match and was just walking through the stands. I actually didn't go as a journalist. I just bought tickets and went to the events. And I was walking through the stands and I overheard some people talking and they said, oh, you know, the father of that guy who's wrestling, he's sitting up there. And I went up there and sure enough, there was this old guy who was, you know, straight out of the countryside, you know, watching his kid wrestle in the Olympics. And I watched him through that entire day. You had this kind of contact. That's not going to be there this time. You can, you know, the commentators are not going to be on the street in Beijing talking to people. They're not going to be in the stands talking to people. It's unclear if they're even going to be fans. I mean, earlier they said they were going to have fans and they're going to be allowed to clap, but they couldn't shout. They were already saying that they're going to reduce the spectators and they may decide to have none at all like Tokyo.
It's amazing what gets leached out of a sporting event when there are no fans, whether it was the NBA playoffs last year or the Tokyo Games. Just the absence of that energy is just so striking, isn't it, Lisa?
Absolutely. And I think it's particularly true for the Olympics because, I mean, part of the Olympics isn't just to figure out who is the best, you know, bobsledder in the world. It's to create these connections between these sudden heroes in our lives. And part of what the Olympics magic is that connection they build out of almost nothing with the crowd. You know, it's so spontaneous and it's so pure in some way. And for that to be gone, we know it's a little sad.
These athletes who have been training since they're children, year after year after year, day after day in a swimming pool, hours and hours, and then the zenith of their career, which is just going to take a minute or two or maybe 15 minutes if it's a long race, it's played out in absolute quiet. It was so strange to see that in Tokyo.
Simone Biles was obviously one of the big stories of Tokyo, and you know, her parents had come to every single one of her meets in her career, in her life. She'd always look up at them and know they were there, and suddenly she looks up, they're not there, you know, and just, obviously that happens. That happens in people's lives, you know, but it happened for this particular reason. And that's true of every single athlete. Part of it is the pride of representing their country and the pride they feel when they see their families and their friends. And that's not there. They really have to figure out how to do it for themselves.
Recently, the Biden administration, as well as Canada, Australia, and I think the UK, all announced that they would have a so-called diplomatic boycott of the Olympics, which meant that their diplomats and government officials would not come to Beijing and sit in the stands.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses. The athletes on Team USA have our full support. We will be behind them 100% as we cheer them on from home. We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the Games.
Have they indicated to the administration?
Do the Chinese care at all, Peter?
Yeah, no, they you know, this kind of thing bothers them, and they will retaliate. You know, in Los Angeles 2028, something will happen. I guarantee you, right? There'll be, and look at the countries that didn't participate in this. France, right? France is 2024. They said that, you know, we're going. There's a reason for that. The Chinese will retaliate. You know, when the Nobel Prize was given, you know, Norway got hit. When Australia called for an investigation into the origins of, you know, the coronavirus, no, you know, Australian beef gets hit, right? So there will be retaliation for this, definitely. The Chinese care. I mean, the real question, I think, is what happens if athletes make statements, which I think is bound to happen. And when an athlete, you know, says something about the internment camps in Xinjiang and the oppression of Muslim people in China, what is the Chinese response going to be? Because the IOC has really just left them out there. I mean, the IOC has said nothing about the political events. They've, you know, basically just washed their hands of it. And really, so it's up to the athletes. And there's not going to be any local dissidents. And so how does the Chinese government respond to that? That's really a big question. And a lot of people that I've talked to are very concerned about this.
Now, given what you're saying, Peter, it seems the responsibility on NBC, the network carrying the Olympics, it's even more intense than ever. Louisa, how does NBC go about playing this? On the one hand, they have a news division. And on the other hand, NBC, as it were, is in business with China, and so is the IOC. So how do they handle this? And how have they handled it in the past?
It's not as it were. They are in business with the IOC. They are actually partners with the IOC. And I imagine that there will be some pretty strong, you know, division between the news division and the broadcast. I mean, you might hear some reference during the opening ceremonies to the diplomatic boycott, but I doubt it. You know, the question will be if athletes are asked at any point about internments or, you know, any of the other questions that could be asked. And if they answer in a certain way, you know, how will NBC report that? If at all, will we see it? Will we know it? You know, that remains to be seen. And the IOC was asked about this, actually. They were saying, what if an athlete protests? And they said, well, that's a hypothetical. I mean, that was the word they used.
I find it strange that the United States in the 80s refused to come to Moscow, and the pretext and the reason for that policy was Afghanistan. At this moment, the Chinese government is doing what it's doing with the Uyghurs, which is an abomination. And yet our protest is much milder. What is the rationale for that?
I mean, I think that there is The Biden administration has said that they don't want to take away the athletes' chance to, you know, you mentioned before, these athletes have trained their whole lives. I think a lot of the athletes who missed out in 1980 were devastated. You know, they've been looking forward to this, and there is a sense that you don't want to punish them for something that China is doing and for some fight that China and the United States are having. Or the UK or any other country. And so they've taken this kind of much milder route. I think that there is less of a focus, a coherent focus on international affairs than there once was. I think that's safe to say. The Cold War was something that Americans broadly understood as being fully invested in. Now, you know, we're a much more fractured society in a lot of ways. And I think that there is not the same sort of sense of social cohesion. Although, you know, obviously we were fractured in all sorts of other ways back then too. So I don't want to make too strong a statement, and I'm speculating a little bit here, but I do think that to a lot of people, what's happening in China feels far away, whereas what was happening with the Soviet Union maybe felt more pressing to your regular Americans.
Well, I think it's also, yeah, just the politics change and the tools change. I think the boycott has become less palatable. You know, this is also, you know, remember the Chinese, they competed in 1952. They didn't compete again until 1984 because the IOC was recognizing athletes from Taiwan. You know, the Chinese had, you know, that long period, 30 years, where they were not part of the Olympic movement. And, you know, the Taiwanese athletes still go. They don't compete under the Taiwanese flag, but it's, you know, the Chinese decided that they wanted to compete. And I think that the idea of a full boycott, an athletic boycott, is not nearly as likely now. And I think that after 1980, there was a general sense that the athletes had paid a high price for missing those games. And so I think people, you know, want to find other tools if they want to speak out about what's going on in Xinjiang.
On the hopes of ending on a high note and maybe a less political note, what athletic performance are you looking forward to in these games? Louisa.
Well, I'm one of those people who actually like watching people, you know, move around on little sticks. So I am really looking forward to the cross country. I think Jesse Diggins is going to be on my TV a lot.
You are killing me. You know the names of cross country skiers.
She's amazing.
Okay, I'm with you. I'll be watching.
I spent just countless hours of my childhood not only watching the Olympics, but recording them on VHS, which kids these days will not have heard of, and then rewatching the Olympics.
Wow.
So I actually did watch a lot of luge and bobsled.
Peter, what athletic performance are you looking forward to?
I like the skiing, and my daughters enjoy it, because we live in Colorado and they ski. So we're watching skiing and snowboarding. They were very excited by Chloe Kim last time, and I suspect we'll be watching her again.
Peter Hessler, Louisa Thomas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Hessler has lived in and reported from China for many years, and Louisa Thomas covers sports for us. You can find all their work at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show this week. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.